So, Leo, if you could give me a brief overview of your work.
Well, the ideas that I'm interested in at the moment, as I look at the conflict management literature, it seems to me one of the ways you can try and get your head around it is to say, on one end of a continuum, there are people who are very concerned with personal psychological change, bringing about change in the way people perceive, understand, etc., the conflict that they're in. At the other end of that continuum, there are people who are extremely concerned about what you might call the objective interests, the concessions that may be made, the power of the participants, etc. And you can see there are extremes on both ends of this continuum. But it seemed to me the real interesting part is where are the crossover points where conflict management takes place? The crossover points being at what stage do we get, if you like, the subjective needs and understandings and beliefs and perceptions and all that stuff meeting with the evidence, the reality, the quote-unquote objective, the interests, these kind of hard things that must be wrestled with. And in trying to figure out where are those crossover points, I'm interested in an idea I came across in a book by Donald Shawn and Martin Ryan called Frame Reflections. And their understanding of frame is that we all have deeply underlying sets of beliefs, perceptions, appreciations, largely unconscious, largely tacit. But it's from those that we figure out what counts as a fact, what is a relevant fact. And very often, of course, people in dispute have very different ideas because their frames drive what counts as relevant, right? So somehow or other, it seems to me in conflict management, we have to get beyond the impasse in which we can't even figure out what is the discourse here, what is the thing. And that's why I'm therefore interested in saying, well, let's start with the idea of frames. Right? Now, the difficulty frames is obviously it's a sort of postmodern kind of thing. Yeah, and the danger, of course, of any of these postmodern kind of things is you wind up in kind of a marsh in which, one idea is as good as another, and it doesn't matter. So,
Yeah.
having acknowledged that danger, we have to figure out, well, how do we sort of become aware that we're all at this, right? We're all. Gareth Morgan, who's a writer in the organizational literature, has a lovely soundbite that I keep quoting. I don't know if it was original to him, but he says, a way of seeing is a way of not seeing, right? And he refers to it like in what he calls images of organization. If you see an organization as a machine, then you're very concerned with things like chain of command and who fits in where. And how different positions are connected and what they need to know. And the underlying assumption is if each person is doing their job right, then the whole thing will work. It's like if each part of the motor does its job, then the whole motor works right. And that's one image. Yeah, if you look at organizations that way, that's what you'll find, right? If, however, you choose to regard organizations as a sort of an information processing brain, right? Then you discover from that metaphor, if you like, of a brain. Well, what is the brain? The brain is actually huge surplus capacity, huge redundancies built in. And then you start saying, well, it's not so much that there are specific jobs with specific tasks. It's more that everybody has access to huge amounts of information, and that information gets put together and recombined in various creative ways. So if you start with that image of an organization, of course, you wind up with very different understandings and a very different diagnosis and a very different prescription, right? Now, same sort of thing, it seems to me, happens if you start looking, if you either as a third party or as a conflict participant, if you go into looking at any conflict situation from a kind of a frame of economic determinism or terrorism or structural violence or poor communications or power politics or any of these kind of things. The danger is that you will get maybe considerable insight, but only partial, right? But we tend to forget that it's only partial, right? It's like the classic story of the three guys, the three blind men feeling the elephant, you know, and each one has a different perception. It may be even worse than that. It may be, if that was all there was, maybe we could stick together all these various partial perceptions and come up with some concept of the whole. But if you think of it in terms of like the physicists' struggles, like, you know, with whether elementary particles are a wave or a particle, all right? And the shattering realization that if you look for a wave, you'll find a wave, and if you look for a particle, you'll find a particle, then that's really kind of mind-blowing for how we understand what is conflict. Because it seems to me that if we then go in saying, yeah, well, I know what's going on here, it's structural violence, yeah, we'll find structural violence, and we'll therefore find how to diagnose that, and therefore we'll find how to fix it, right? If you go in saying, well, actually, this is to do with the fact that these people are not communicating and cannot communicate, and that you'll probably find that, and similarly, you will diagnose it and analyze it and prescribe for it in those kind of ways.
Basic human needs. Look at that. The basic human needs aren't being met, just like I thought. And then here's the prescription.
Yes, I think this is true. I think the basic human needs thing is lurking behind all of these frames somewhere. You know, that in some ways, the frames are never value-free. There's always some kind of thing lurking behind, which probably is in the domain of basic human needs. And that's one of the reasons why we're so reluctant to look at these, right? And we have very elaborate defenses, both as individuals and as organizations, right? Very elaborate defenses for not looking at our most fundamental assumptions, right? Because it's uncomfortable, it's painful, right? And immediately we get in defensive messages saying, "Hoy, that would threaten one of these basic human needs, which this thing is designed to look out for and serve." Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So contextualize this for me then. In a given conflict, pick one. There's plenty out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of, you know, getting people to sort of recognize that there's their set of facts and that there are other facts out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Depending on how you look at it. And then, secondly, as a practitioner, you're going to find what you look for is basically what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that leave me?
Well, you see, in any given conflict, you're probably arriving with stuff that emerges from deeply held frames, because frames tend to give rise to models, working models and heuristics and so on and so forth. So you go in with maybe some conception of a just war, right? Or maybe some conception of legitimate self-defense, or maybe some heuristic, like, you know, the old Latin tag, civis pacem parabellum, you know, if you really desire peace, you must prepare for war. Mm. This underlies an awful lot of thinking. It's not often made, or sometimes it is made quite explicit, you know. We really, if you want peace, what you got to do is have very considerable defensive armaments or whatever built up.
And deterrence arguments.
Deterrence arguments, yeah. And those kind of things are lurking there. Or maybe even something that looks a bit more innocuous. I always remember the first time I came to the United States, it was to New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, at least at that stage, all the car license plates had live free or die. Yeah?
Still do.
They still do. And I used to wonder, God, we're going to have a hard time teaching these people about getting away from win-lose and either-or conceptions of conflict, right? Because from the time they were so high, they've been living with live free or die. So now, your question was, so where does this leave us? And I think where it's leaving us is with a need to really learn our way out of conflict. And what that means is a willingness to go in and really look at these basic frames, these basic assumptions that both we ourselves make as third parties. I think one of the things, as Susan was saying there, know yourself. You know, where am I coming from? You know, and to go into the discomfort and the dissonance of that. And also then to work with other people to help overcome the defenses and so on that are there, to help them really look at where they are coming from. Because only in that way does it seem to me we can get to that crossover point that I talked about earlier. It's only when we kind of clear this stuff out of the road that we can then get looking at things like evidence. What are facts? Now, I would subscribe there are no value-free facts actually either, you know. So, but let's at least make our assumptions explicit about the kind of facts we want to look at here, right? And can both parties, or if they're multi-parties, can we at least get some kind of frame of reference in which we can agree to look at this? It might be something like sort of saying, well, what is our vision of the future of this country, right? And that's in itself going to immediately trip people into very fundamental things like, yeah, the future of this country is we got to basically go for ethnic cleansing, we got to have partition, we got to have regional autonomy, we have to have secession, we have to have reunification with our ethnic brothers down the road, etc., etc., right? That's one vision. Another vision, if you like, and I guess this was the incredible vision of Nelson Mandela, was despite everything to say the vision of the future is a multi-ethnic, you know, multi-racial, multi-coloured South Africa. Right? And into that sort of vision, then all sorts of people can sort of say, okay, well, what would that look like? What would it look like in terms of government, in terms of justice, in terms of administration, in terms of policing, in terms of education, in terms of jobs, and so on and so forth, yeah? Mm-hmm. Well, until we kind of can get to that crossover point where we leave some of we kind of hold our basic assumptions in suspension, then we can start to do business, right? And not before. Similarly, if you go back to, how many years ago was it when people started talking about creativity as being essential for conflict management, right? But frames, deeply held frames, inhibit creativity, even without our being aware of it. We simply cannot be creative. We don't have the psychic energy, the freedom, to look at alternatives, to visualize alternatives for joint gain, any of those things. They do take energy. And we don't have that energy because it's robbed, if you like, by the pain of what it might do to some of our most dearly cherished assumptions.
Mm-hmm. So asking about what the future would look like is one way to get at those assumptions. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas of other ways to get there?
Well, I think there's a number of things that seem to me interesting kind of straws in the wind. It's not all done by thinking, right? Some of it is done almost by a kind of meditative process, right? In some ways, thinking is part of the problem, right? And we really need to almost get into a state, first of all, for ourselves, and then ideally with others, in which we're almost kind of in a state where we are suspending our normal thought processes, right? And I think some of the work that Len Riskin has been doing for lawyers, encouraging them to basically meditate, right? And the extraordinary response that this is evoking from kind of hard-nosed, practical, practicing lawyers, saying, yeah, you know, we got to kind of get out of some of our existing routines of, you know, they may be useful, adversarialism and et cetera, may be useful, but we also need to get into some kind of difference. So that's one thing that occurs to me. The other is analogy, of course, and that brings us back to, I think, maybe the intractable knowledge, the intractable conflict knowledge base, is a lot of learning can take place by analogy, right? You really need to step back from your own conflict in which you're immersed, and look at somebody else's, right? I think that's part of what learning is. These are not brand new stuff. I think many of the practitioners have known this for years. You know that working by analogy is a way of learning, which sometimes brings insight in a way which is, but the insight is blocked if you try and look at it in your own parish, if you like, or your own back door. Those kinds of things, yeah.
So by analogy, you mean someone, say, steeped in the Northern Ireland conflict might take a step back and look at where, for example, and get some insight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it has been done and is being done, you know, where people look at other people's conflicts and look at the dynamics. And, of course, some of these dynamics are similar and they will each have their own particular cultural, historical, and political, and economic, particularity. But some of the things, the essence of the thing is to stop the defence rushing in, right? I mean, the classic example is in the Old Testament. You know, the poor, I forget which prophet it was, but he gets the message from God to go and confront King David about the fact that he has not only been living in sin with somebody else's wife, but has actually caused her husband to be murdered, or at least killed. And of course, from the point of view, walking up to your king, pretty all-powerful sovereign, and saying, you know, excuse me, but I got to tell you, I have a message from God for you, is a hard way of doing it. So he goes about it and says, you know, Your Majesty, I would like justice for somebody in your kingdom. Right, and this poor guy had only got one sheep, you know, but somebody else who was his neighbour, who had about 1,000 sheep, came and stole it from him. It's not something you want to push too far, because it might be a bit offensive to women. But of course, King David jumps up off his throne. He says, "This is totally unjust. Bring me this man, and I'm going to punish him as nobody's ever been punished." And the old prophet, well, he doesn't exactly say gotcha, but it boils down to the same thing.
Right.
This is a classic case of learning by analogy, but you can also do it in various other ways.
Yeah? Sure. So the idea is some sort of self-revelation in that sense. You ensconce in your own conflict, would have a look at another conflict and say, wow, I can't believe they're behaving like that.
Yeah.
And then in that second you say, wait a minute,
yeah,
that's exactly what we do.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think and it is used, of course, it's sometimes used quite deliberately. It was used in Northern Ireland, you know, where there's a deliberate attempt on the part of John Hume to say to the other guys, look, this is not the way you think of it. You're thinking of this as an imperialist conflict, da 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 da, in which there's an imperialist aggressor is seeking it. It's actually not that. It's much more like Cyprus, right? And if you think about Cyprus, you know, you have two conflicting communities, right? And the problem is, how do they share power on this one island, right? And that's the way the power holder, which in this case was Britain, they actually don't care, right? And we can get them to say that they don't care what the solution is, so long as we can agree on it between these two communities. Now, it took some years. It took some years, but gradually people began, it took, and there's a number of other issues, gradually people began to reconceptualize what is the nature of this conflict. And so I say, well, if that's the nature of it, then we've got to persuade these other guys, yeah. And it's hard to persuade people if you're all in them, yeah. And so on and so forth.
Analogies and let's see, meditation, and the other was the future visioning.
Yeah.
For a third party going in there, I guess the meditation idea would apply, but the other two really wouldn't. And yet, the third party needs to be aware of their own frames.
They need to be aware of their own frames, and in some respects, they need to be aware that the goals are not preset, right? Mm. That the process is so important, right? And this actually puts a certain demand, it seems to me, on the third party. Because it's one thing to be in a position of power and to say, okay, I'll go in here, I'll mediate this, or I'll negotiate this, and I'm I'm a kind of person who's been through this several times. I know where they're going to wind up. I know what the issues are. And I'll just help them with the process until they get to where I know they're going to get to in X period of time, right? It's much more demanding if you actually go into one of these situations where you say, I don't know really what the outcome is. I may have some ideas. But the goal is unclear to everybody, including myself. In fact, the nature of the problem, we still haven't really figured out. And there's an intriguing phrase from two guys called March and Olson in the organizational literature, and they said, change develops meaning through the process by which it occurs. Change develops meaning through the process by which it occurs, and I still am trying to get my head around that every day. But it continues to challenge me because our conception of rationality is so strongly goal-driven, right? You know, and I'm not saying that this is irrational. I don't think it is, but I think it is a sort of discovery, right? And it's a voyage of discovery towards a destination that actually nobody may know. And that's pretty scary, you know, both for the participants themselves and also for the third party, to be able to have that kind of definition. And that is in some ways why I have one reservation about the intractable conflict knowledge base, and that is that it implies a theory of learning that seems to me to be overly passive. Like, you know, sort of, there is the body of knowledge, and in you go, you tap into that, and da, da, da. But it always seems to me that, as Piaget says, thought presupposes action, right? And learning takes place in activity, right? So in an ideal world, as well as the nuggets and the diamonds in the mountain, which we will facilitate people to access, in an ideal world, I would like to see, and there's some, I think other people have worked on this, thought too, some sort of online interactive facility whereby there would be almost a kind of dialogue process with the knowledge. It might even, in practical terms, come down to not only people accessing the knowledge base, but doing assignments on it related to their particular conflict or their particular interest or their particular thing. And in the light of that, engaging in some kind of dialogue, right? Now, I fully appreciate an online dialogue is not the same as the fullness of a human person in a third party, such as we were talking about earlier. But having said that, in educational terms, it seems to me that we need to go a bit beyond simply saying, here's this wonderful resource which you can tap into. I'd like to see us reaching for a sort of action learning, action research almost mode in which people could interact with that.
Mm. That's really interesting because Susan, who was just here, had a similar idea.
All right.
She had mentioned that she thought the website needed to be more sort of multimedia approach and more sort of interesting to the average passerby and also interactive to an extent like you're sort of suggesting.
Yeah.
I wonder if that'll be a theme in the next couple of days.
It'd be interesting to see, yeah.
So in terms of advice to practitioners, one of the things that you just said is that they shouldn't assume that they know what's going to happen or where it's going or even what the outcome is going to be. They're sort of riding on a boat on the way to somewhere.
Yes. Yeah.
But we don't know where.
Yeah.
And that actual boat ride, given that one quote that you just read, will sort of determine our understanding of what that change was. In other words, that journey.
Yes.
So what other advice would you give to practitioners?
I think in terms of the continuum that I mentioned earlier on, right? I think there's merit in both of those insights into conflict. But I think it is important to hold both of them, right? At the risk of caricaturing it, I think one has to, at least I am of the opinion, one has to accept that while there is a huge amount of work that needs to be done on people's psychology and perceptions and so on, and feelings and all of that sort of stuff. Nonetheless, there are realistic issues that need to be sorted out. Now, maybe they can't be sorted out, which I think is the thrust of what I'm saying, until some work has been done there. Mm-hmm. Equally, at the other extreme, if you like, I think while there are grounds for saying there is such a thing as power politics, there is such a thing as realistic conflict, there are such things as real conflicts of interest, right? They do exist. But at the same time, I think one needs to understand that they are not as objective as all that, right? That they are always perceived through interpretive schemes, and that in order to, which is why one reason why things that seemed utterly, incredibly important at one point in time seem to be basically negotiated, capable of being negotiated away later. So they always exist through these. And consequently, I think the our understanding of third party interventions must be to try and hold both of these together, right? And I think that's reflecting the way at least I understand conflict management. Right?
So sort of steering between the objective and the relative, in a sense. Steering between we'll find what we look for and this is what's actually there right now.
Yeah. Or maybe not so much steering between as trying to hold both in the one conceptual frame, right? Which is uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's no easy task, is it?
Yeah.
Let's see here. You've made a few references to organizational literature.
Yeah.
Do you think that there... I mean, it's funny because I've talked to a few other practitioners who've done similar things, which is not a body that I'm particularly familiar with, but it seems to have a great deal of relevance for conflict resolution without calling itself conflict resolution literature.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I do. I think they're doing things in relation to learning and in relation to understanding organizations, which we can learn about, which we could borrow, if you like. You know, again, to quote Morgan, you know, he's saying, If you want to understand the environment, you have to start by understanding yourself. And if you want to change someone's understanding of the environment, you have to start with changing their understandings of themselves, right? Because to some extent, our understanding of the environment is always a projection of ourselves, right? Which is why, of course, we have tended to fish out large tracts of the oceans. because if my understanding of myself as a fisherman is that I'm somebody who goes and fishes, right? And I don't have a systemic understanding of the relationship between myself and the environment, then, you know, I'm simply going to be driven to go and fish, you know, and so on.
Do you mean to say that if you don't have an understanding of the system, that you're not likely to fish in a manner that is sustainable, and so eventually you're going to deplete the resources?
Absolutely, okay. Yeah. Without some systemic understanding, we run into situations where the easiest thing to do is to blame somebody else, right? And we easily trip into these kind of, you know, games. In the game theory sense, or social dilemmas in the sense that Dawes uses it, right? That underlying the difficulties that you and I are in, there is actually a systemic relationship, right? Which we may be actually making worse, right? By our attempts to negotiate our conflict, yeah? So there's a kind of that kind of thing needs to be in there. But that needs a bit more explanation than I'm giving it at the moment.
Sure.
But your answer was from the organizational literature. I mean, basically, I think what people are saying now, the real basis of competitive advantage is on people's ability to learn, right? And it seems to me an awful lot of what's done in the name of conflict resolution or conflict management is essentially getting people or helping people to learn their way out of the difficulties that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think there's a crossover there. Yeah.
What else should we talk about?
Well, I suppose the other thing that occurs to me is of course, that I haven't really mentioned in the thing, is trust, right? And the that's maybe another necessary condition before people can allow themselves to question their most treasured assumptions, yeah? And whether the third party, if there's a third party, can create conditions in which trust can take place, yeah? That's particularly difficult in situations in which there is either previous violence or even ongoing violence, right? And you get into some of Walton's classic paper on two strategies of social change and their dilemmas, where he's sort of saying, well, from time to time, people will engage in an attitude-changing strategy, and at other times, they will engage in power bargaining. And in the ultimate, of course, power bargaining may be violence, right? Mm-hmm. This is extremely difficult, I think, for a third party to manage, again, to hold in one conceptual arena an understanding of both of those ways of dealing with reality. Yeah, it also raises huge problems of trust, right? Because it boils down to the fact that the people who are making peace overtures are maybe at the same time engaging in violence. And that, for most people, I guess, in the conflict-resolving field, are people who personally are totally committed to non-violent ways of dealing with it. So this is very challenging, and we need to kind of develop ways of dealing with that and ways of detoxing from it, because it's very challenging.
So how does trust factor into a situation where there is a threat of violence? I mean, it sounds like you're suggesting that violence is one way of dealing with conflict, which I think is... pretty much we can agree on that, right?
Yeah.
That seems to be one of the common forms, anyway. And yet, as third parties, we have this commitment to nonviolence, to a certain extent. Does that affect the way we develop trust with the parties that we're involved with at all? Or, I mean, because our implicit assumption is that violence is not a viable option, and yet the parties we're dealing with think that it is. Does that affect their trust of our interventions, or trust of each other? Or, I mean...
Well, I think the difficulty with any kind of violence, of course, is that it's extremely corrosive of any trust between the participants, right? And it's to create those conditions, right, really involves a huge kind of work on exchanging meanings between those people, like creating the conditions for any kind of dialogue almost certainly means some sort of cessation of violence, right? And even there, again, as we've seen in Northern Ireland, the cessation of violence is hugely problematic, in that people will immediately sort of say, yeah, but I don't want to negotiate to somebody who has a gun in my head, you know? So the fact that you stop today, does that mean you're stopping for all time? And will you sign up to principles of, you know, non-violent ways of dispute resolution and so on?
Mm-hmm.
The personal willingness of the third parties in those situations, their personal integrity and their personal, ways of listening but not necessarily agreeing, right, are crucial, I think, to trying to bring about a situation where people can move on and can agree to engage in a non-violent dialogic process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's huge. It even boils down to the fact that, you know, can trust survive the odd stab in the back, right? You can see this in a less serious context in the industrial relations arena. You very often have to create those kind of situations. One of my favorite recollections when I was in industrial relations many years ago, was a particularly troublesome shop steward who was really hard to deal with. But he was very intelligent. I kind of respected that. I also felt that in a more ideal world, he would not have been in the job he was in. He would have gone on, and he'd have gone to college and so on and so forth. But anyway, we had fought it out at the bit.
You as the mediator?
No. This is when I was in the personnel manager role.
Oh, I see.
So we had fought out on many occasions. One time he came into my office and he hummed and hawed for a bit and shuffled around, and then he finally came out with the thing. He said that we were going to not mediation but something close to arbitration. And he finally said, "I just wanted to know." He said, "I just want you to know." He said, "When we go there tomorrow, something you said last week, I'm going to quote it against you, right?" And I really thought, well, how delightful.
Yeah.
You know, he's telling me in advance he's going to stab me in the back. So, and this, in a sense, is trust is not unidimensional either. I was delighted, you know.
So that was part of the trust building. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You say,
this is what I'm going to do.
I'm sorry, but
you know?
Look out.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I thought, yeah, well, that's on that relationship you can actually build a lot.
Huh. Yeah. So is that something we can take out to a larger context?
I don't know. It's a very in a larger context where there's violence, which we're already describing about. I'm not so sure, but certainly in some other ways, I think the trust building process. It's crucial, but it's more subtle than we sometimes give it credit for.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, okay, so other things about trust, other things on this paper? I just look this over.
Well, I think we've probably dealt with most of it.
Yeah.
Lessons
learned along the way, insights like that last one?
Well, I think, you know, the other thing is, that, as I said, a way of seeing really is a way of not seeing, and that's also comes up in, I think, what many mediators, experienced mediators, would know, that in order to make progress, you really have to get into the other person's head, each of the other party's heads, right? And then the difficulty is getting out again and holding both your own role and these two very conflicting roles together. And that's the mediator's art. It's one example of the mediator's art is to get beyond the particular way of seeing and at the same time respect it, but bring the parties to a position in which you're saying there are other aspects to reality, there are other sides to the elephant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While preserving their own view at the same time.
Preserving their own view, yeah.
There's your piece of the elephant. You feel that, and it's accurate from your point of view.
Yes, yeah.
But there is also this other piece.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, you know, the mediator who can get a participant to hold both worlds in their mind at the same time is quite an expert.
Yeah, yeah. It's That's where change comes from, like in terms of a kind of gestalt that we may not be able to actually hold both, but it's like one of those kind of gestalt images. If occasionally you can see it flipping, yeah. And you can see, my God, there might actually be a way of another way, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes that is so insightful that you don't want to do it again, because that means, like, if I really allowed that insight in, I would have to shift my own position. I would have to shift my own understanding, not just my position, but my own understanding, and so on. And sometimes that's where the defensive routines come in. Yeah.
How do you mitigate the sort of defensiveness that comes from what would seem like true progress like that? You say, wow, this is possible. And you say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What does this mean for me and mine?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's where it really needs, as I was saying, it needs something almost beyond thought. It can't be kind of logicked in. It's in the domain much more of insight. It's in the domain of maybe a slow process that's happening over time. It's really in the domain of recognizing the inconsistencies and the incoherences in our own thought, right? And that's never going to be easy because that's kind of full of dissonance, you know. But that's where learning comes from, yeah. But it's also where discomfort comes from. And the maybe another role of the mediator is to help people manage that discomfort, right? And kind of live with it, yeah. Which is why I kind of come back to saying, yeah, it's not it can't be logicked in, but it may be that there's some kind of atmosphere, and this is, I think, the art of the mediator is to create. Through their own person, through the kind of things Susan was talking about, through the reality of their own human personhood, to the quality of their listening, to the quality of their presence, through the permissions that they both ask for and give, right, to the parties, to experience. Some things that are very difficult for them to experience, maybe even to articulate, was very difficult for them to articulate. Mm. Yeah. So yes, I'm a believer in process.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Leo, thanks so much for spending the time with me.
You're most welcome.
What sort of lessons can we apply from the organizational development world to conflict resolution?
Well, I think there are some common dynamics, some differences, obviously, but I think that there are really experienced organization development consultants have some very interesting stories to tell about how you function in getting people to change and how you function in getting people to reach insight. And of course, very often, the reason that people are called in OD is because the organization is ridden with conflict. A friend of mine who's a very good OD consultant used to tell the story. It's always stuck in my mind. He said, sometimes people won't tell you what the problem is, but they'll actually demonstrate it for you. And the story he used to illustrate this was he'd been asked to consult with this company, a business company, and they were all set to do 2 days of consulting. And he and his assistant arrived, and they were starting with a dinner the night before. And it so happened they were in a hotel with small round tables, and his assistant was seated next to the CEO of the company. And, of course, naturally, during the dinner, they got to talk. Following morning, first session, they arrive in the conference room. Everything is prepared. He has thought of how he's going to run this session, what he's going to do, what they're going to do about diagnosis, what they're going to do about sharing, so on. But before he can say anything, the chief executive announces very aggressively, points at his assistant and says, I'm not fucking working with this guy. And he said, well, gosh, of all the things I had not prepared for, it was to have my assistant fired in the first minute, right? Right. So, and he says, I'm there thinking, now I have to spend 2 days. It's hard enough to do it with two people, but now I'm going to have to spend 2 days working on my own. But on the other hand, he said, you know, it might have taken us a long time to work at what is the problem here. And obviously one of the problems here is that the CEO occasionally goes into these kind of loops. Mm-hmm. But he didn't tell us. He has actually demonstrated it for us. So that's what we'll do. We'll work with that. That's the data, right? Yeah. And take it from there.
Which is more than any employee would have said with the CEO sitting right in the room.
Absolutely.
Saying, you know what the problem is?
Absolutely.
This guy over here sometimes gets in these moods and makes these rash decisions and fires people.
Yes.
Or whatever the example may be.
That's where we'll go from. And we'll explore, like, including himself, like, how do people deal with this, and that and so on and so forth.
Well, what's the decision-making process?
What's the decision-making process around here?
Is that it right there? Is that it?
You could be a long time talking about participative decision-making in that organization. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah.